From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we feature the first in a two-part conversation with the head of refugee resettlement for the U.S. Department of State. Larry Bartlett was in Salt Lake City in recent days to meet with resettled refugees and the local agencies involved in helping them get their footing in their new community. Salt Lake City, he says, could serve as a model for the country when it comes to welcoming refugees.
This program we've recognized for many years as being kind of a shining example of how communities can work closely with resettlement agencies and resettlement workers to help refugees make the transition into self-sufficiency.
That conversation, your top local headlines, and more after this world news from the BBC and Access Downtown. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up a little bit later on the show, we're going to have a conversation about why Salt Lake City is a model for resettling refugees. But first up, we have these headlines. Utah officials are prepared to ask the U.S. Supreme Court to intervene in a lawsuit filed by same-sex couples demanding to have their marriages recognized. Attorneys for Utah said in court filings on Monday that they'll appeal to the high court if a federal appeals court lifts the hold on a requirement to move forward with benefits for about 1,000 gay marriages in the state. U.S. District Judge Dale Kimball in Utah ruled in favor of gay and lesbian couples last month, setting the implementation date of his order for Monday. But last week, a Denver-based appeals court granted Utah's request to temporarily delay that ruling. Utah officials argue that if the marriages are recognized now, it will jeopardize their legal appeal of Kimball's ruling. The gay couples suing the state have asked the court to reverse its decision. Monday marks the first day of the Summer Food Service Program in Salt Lake City. The city's school district offers free lunches to children in lieu of lunches they'd normally receive throughout the school year. But for the first time ever, students can get their lunches at Salt Lake City's main library. KCBW's Ryan Cunningham tells us more.
The Salt Lake City School District has been feeding students during the summer break for almost 40 years. Kelly Orton, the school district's director of child nutrition, says the summer food service program is important in keeping some kids fed.
It's very important. If you don't have a meal at home, if you're going hungry, this is a great thing to have for those children. We have a lot of those in low-income areas in the area, in the city, and it's a needed resource, I think, to the city. To this area.
Orton says the local initiative is part of a federally funded program that aims to serve low-income children with proper nutrition while they're out of school. Things like fruits, veggies, and whole grains can be found in the lunches. This year, the city's school district has teamed up with the Salt Lake City Public Library to serve students at the main library downtown. The library's director, John Spears, hopes the pairing will draw kids into the library and nurture interest in the library services.
We were talking with the school district about some of the partnership opportunities that we had, and this just seemed like a really natural fit for us. We want to get as many kids into the library as possible, and being able to work with another entity to get them into the library was advantageous to both.
Spears hopes the library can strengthen their partnership with the school district in the future. For example, Spears says the library is looking into giving a library card to every registered student in the Salt Lake City School District. That could happen as soon as the fall when students are going back to school. For KCPW News, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
New patients seeking care at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Salt Lake City waited 73 days on average for care, one of the top 10 longest average wait times in the nation. A report released by the Veterans Affairs Department on Monday also says that there are 447 patients who had to wait more than 90 days for an initial medical appointment at the Salt Lake City VA Hospital. The report is the first nationwide look at the VA system after reports of patients dying while awaiting appointments at the Phoenix VA Center. The audit looked at 731 VA hospitals and large outpatient clinics across the country. The report shows 92% of all appointments in Salt Lake City are scheduled within 30 days. Another 8%, or 2,319 appointments, took more than 30 days to schedule. For a brief moment in time, it appeared that Salt Lake City might have a shot at hosting the 2016 Democratic National Convention, especially after being put on the party's, quote, shortlist for candidate host cities. Still, Utah's capital city was a long shot for the honor. Recognizing this, city officials nixed the possibility, citing the financial competitiveness of other candidate cities. Matt Lyon, executive director of the Utah Democratic Party, says that while the city won't be hosting the 2016 convention, just being considered shows how far Salt Lake has come.
I think it shows the growing stature and importance of what the Utah Democratic Party is doing here in Utah, along with Mayor Becker, Mayor McAdams, and Congressman Matheson, and how they're respected really nationally, and that Utah is seen as a real place of activity. The Democrats, national Democrats look to.
Lyon says that while 2016 won't be the year for Salt Lake to host a convention, there are a lot of reasons to reconsider the city as a host later on.
I mean, Salt Lake has some incredible resources. I mean, it's like the track lines and the light rail that are going in, up and down the Wasatch Front really open up, public transit and transportation here to Utah. I think downtown is really turning around, rising, has lots of activity and livelihood and opportunities.
Art Raymond of the Salt Lake City Mayor's Office says it was a great honor for the city to be considered, but ultimately the city recognized that it was a long shot. Still, Raymond says the city appreciates that both the Republican and Democratic parties are acknowledging the city as a significant regional center, and he wouldn't rule out a bid for a convention in the future. And that does it for our summary of the day's top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're tuned into The Rundown. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Now on the show, we turn to the first in a two-part conversation with the head of refugee resettlement at the U.S. Department of State. Larry Bartlett was in Salt Lake City in recent days to highlight how our city is a model when it comes to resettling refugees. Bartlett toured the International Rescue Committee's New Roots Project, a community garden where refugees reconnect with the land and plant their roots, both literally and figuratively. And he also visited a local farm where refugees are helping to raise goats. Bartlett met with local resettled refugees, resettlement agencies, and community stakeholders to showcase Salt Lake City's streamlined partnership between federal, state, and local authorities and the private sector, with the aim of exploring how refugee resettlement here could serve as a model for dozens of communities across the United States. Larry Bartlett, Director of Refugee Resettlement at the State Department, joined us in studio to talk about his visit and his work. Larry Bartlett, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
As Director of Refugee Admissions, you oversee worldwide refugee arrivals and resettlement to the United States. This may seem a bit elementary, but could you tell us what distinguishes a refugee from other immigrants to the U.S.?
Sure. First of all, the United States is a very large and welcoming country for refugees. Refugees are people who have fled their homeland. They have crossed an international border, and they have a well-founded fear of persecution if they were to return. So I think the classic example now would be Syrian refugees. They are fleeing civil conflict inside Syria. They are leaving. They are not involved in the combat. They are looking for shelter and safety. So families have moved into adjoining countries like Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan that are welcoming them. So they've crossed an international border. They have a fear of returning to Syria and being killed if they were to return. And so they are sheltering in place at the moment. So that is a traditional refugee situation. It is not somebody who is coming to the United States to look for work. It is not somebody who comes through a visa process because they have a family member who might have petitioned for them to join. But they are, again, somebody who cannot return home and needs another solution.
Mm-hmm. Last year alone, the U.S. admitted nearly 70,000 refugees to 49 states. You mentioned Syria, but where are the bulk of these refugees coming from currently?
Right. So last year, we had a target of 70,000 refugees admitted to the United States, and we met that target. It was the closest time in the last 20 years that we've met that target. We actually anticipate resettling another 70,000 this year, which is also our target. Refugees last year and I think this year will predominantly come from four places: Iraq, Bhutan, Burma, and Somalia. And those are really our largest populations. Iraqis, we have a special program inside Iraq, which serves those people who have worked with the U.S. military and with the U.S. government. But we also are resettling Iraqis from other parts of the Middle East that they have fled to.
I had Utah Refugee Services Office Director Gerald Brown on the program before to talk about the millions of Syrian refugees that are out there right now. You mentioned crossing borders going to places like Jordan. There are massive refugee camps there, millions of displaced people, and it represents a pretty incredible crisis. I'm wondering if the U.S. is considering that, or if that's something that can be addressed from a refugee resettlement program in the immediate future.
It's a great question. The refugee program, what people need to understand is that it has different facets. So in a refugee emergency like Syria, you have people coming across a border. They're looking for immediate protection. And the UN is really our main partner, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. We provide funding to the UN to implement their programs in the neighboring countries. So we really expect the neighboring countries to open their border, but we want to help those countries serve the refugees who are put into camps or living perhaps in an urban environment, make sure that they have food, they have shelter, they have protection, they have health care. That's really the initial response. And we're at the point now in the Syria crisis where we're moving from initial response into resettlement because we don't have safety, we don't have peace in Syria. Mm-hmm. And we also have a tremendous strain on countries like Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon to continue to host these refugees. So there's a large effort right now to resettle 30,000 Syrians this year and 50,000 next year and 50,000 in 2016 from the region. It was interesting you noted, talked about the numbers. Right now, the number of Syrian refugees is 2.8 million. Mm-hmm. It's a huge, huge number. We've already spent, the U.S. government on behalf of the taxpayers have spent about $2 billion in humanitarian assistance in the region because, our initial obligation is really to help those countries serve the refugees that they're hosting, to help the refugees make sure they have shelter. So we're putting assistance in the region where it belongs, but now we're starting to transition to also look at resettlement into the United States.
I mean, the ideal in any conflict is that it resolves and people can return to their homes. But then at some point, resettlement becomes the reality.
That's correct. I mean, America is a great country. Obviously, all of us are happy that we are American citizens. But having said that, refugees really have come from another country and they have their own affiliations and their own love of their own country. So that's where they have their culture. That's where they have their language. That's where they have property. So they're really, their first interest is to return home. So it's why so many refugees will shelter in place in a nearby area, in a nearby country, in hopes to return home. It's often only after the first 5 years of a situation that people will then begin to consider resettlement. But for example, the Bhutanese refugees we've been resettling from Nepal, mm-hmm. they were in exile for 20 years, and they had no hope of going back to Bhutan. Bhutan would not allow them to return. And so the international community, frankly led by the U.S., looked at resettlement as a way to resolve that situation.
And that is that a similar situation to those Burmese refugees?
So the Burmese refugees is another example, similar to Bhutan or the Bhutanese refugees in Nepal, where people had fled Burma for tens of years. Many of them were in camps in Thailand. Also, a very large number have been living in Malaysia, not in camps, but in urban areas. And again, although both countries were generous in allowing people to remain there, the services and support that they were able to access was fairly limited. So in the situation of Burma, although we have improvement inside that country, we're still not at a level or at a place where the UN is recommending people return, mm-hmm. so that people still are in exile in those countries especially. There are also Burmese who are in exile in Bangladesh. We've had very large resettlement out of Thailand and Malaysia for the last 5-6 years. Some of those programs will start to wind down as we think conditions improve inside Burma.
Right.
But there is one group, I would say, in Burma that is worth talking about, and that's the Rohingya. And this is a Muslim group that's located up in the northwest section of Burma. There is still quite a bit of violence against that population by other members of that community. There continues to be of exodus happening from Burma. Mm-hmm. People are taking to boats. It's pretty easy to find articles about the tragic boat crossings that people endure to try to find safety either in southern Thailand or Malaysia. So we will be continuing to resettle the Rohingya population for Burma, I'm afraid, for some years to come.
Okay. You mentioned earlier the 70,000-person target for this year and for last year as well. How is the target set, and is it kind of a cap, and how does that work?
The target is a cap. It's the number that we are permitted to resettle. the target is set along with budget, so that we need to make sure that we have the right federal budget, both from the State Department as well as Health and Human Services, to support refugees once they've arrived into the U.S. So we do that very consciously. We look also at the refugee resettlement need across the world. We're not the only country that resettles refugees. There are about 27 in the world that resettle refugees, but we are the largest. And our 70,000 is more than all other countries combined. It's something that we work actively on to promote other countries to resettle refugees. Canada and Australia are large resettlement countries, but each of them about 12,000 a year. So we do dwarf them. But having said that, we're not able to solve all the refugee resettlement issues in the world. We want to play a meaningful role, and we want to encourage others to do the same. So we do try to calibrate the program, but we will probably be growing it slightly in years to come to meet the increased demand.
You know, I don't have too much of your time, so I want to move to a question about your visit here. You're in Utah for a few days looking at how refugee placement is happening in the state. This is being cited as a model. Why is the model here a good one for resettlement?
You're correct in saying that Utah has been a model resettlement state, and certainly Salt Lake City a model resettlement community. There are two agencies here that are funded by the U.S. government and work closely with the state and the community. One is Catholic Community Services, and the other is the International Rescue Committee. Both of those are members of our nationwide program that have affiliates here in Salt Lake City. This program we've recognized for many years as being a kind of a shining example of how communities can work closely with resettlement agencies and resettlement workers to help refugees make the transition into self-sufficiency, which is really the ultimate goal of our program. So when refugees arrive, they're dependent on the government, in some part the federal government, but more the state and the local government, and a whole host of volunteers and community workers to help them make this transition to this new country and this new culture. But the program depends or really requires people to become self-sufficient. This is not a government service that's going to be provided forever. Mm-hmm. So we do have at least 8 months in most communities in the United States, at least 8 months of support for refugees, but it's really to help make the transition, help them find jobs, to help them get their kids into school, to access health services. And the idea is that people will become self-sufficient, they'll become taxpayers, they'll become citizens of the community, and they will become citizens of our country. That's really the goal. And it doesn't happen without strong community support, and it doesn't happen without strong volunteerism. And I think in the case of Salt Lake City, we've seen that it's really been kind of a shining example of where things work well. So we have strong support, I know, from volunteer community. We have strong support from the Church of Latter-day Saints. We have strong support from the local government. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think has really made Utah special is that the state was able to leverage funds in such a way to provide extended services to refugees for 24 months. And the services, I think, they're not about providing A to Z services so people don't have to work. They're providing case management. So they've got officials who are working, you know, experts who are working from the resettlement agencies to help people for a longer period of time stabilize their lives and to find meaningful employment. So this 24-month model has really, I think, been kind of the gold standard that we've asked other communities around the U.S. to try to replicate.
And it's essentially these organizations providing, I mean, you say support, but what we're talking about, instead of just material or financial support, we're talking about actual volunteers spending time helping people integrate or understand their community better, being able to access employment services, et cetera, and so on.
Absolutely, because one of the challenges that we face is a lot of refugees have come out of camps, not all, and maybe even less than half. But for those people who have been in camps for 10 or 20 years, they've become dependent, and it's really through no fault of their own. They haven't been allowed to work in many of these countries. They've been provided food through the UN system. They've been provided shelter. So they've kind of lost some of their incentives and initiatives. So it really is important that people find a way to embrace the self-sufficient model that we expect, I think, of any American.
We've been speaking with Larry Bartlett, Director of Refugee Resettlement at the U.S. State Department. Tomorrow, we'll conclude this conversation by examining the unique challenges refugees face when they arrive to the United States, looking at the delicate tension between maintaining cultural traditions and assimilation, and more. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're tuned into The Rundown. We'll be right back. Thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. Additional help came from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. We're on the air each weekday at 5 p.m. here on KCPW, but you can also find us on Twitter. Our handle is at KCPWRundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.